Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, we would like to welcome you to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again. We've been away for, we're back after 3 weeks of basically a vacation. Ruth Ann was on vacation. Myself, I was away from doing the broadcast for that 3 weeks, but I almost feel like I was on vacation even though I was going to work every day. So anyway, we're very glad to have you back joining us. Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, from time to time, you come up with many interesting topics that you put on Facebook, on Twitter, on your blog site, and we like to explore those topics. One of the topics that you had, one of the things you were discussing recently was systemic and also institutionalized racism, and also the history of how institutionalized racism has gone from generation to generation, and we have seen that in many countries. But, Alan, what I would like for you to do is first explain what do you mean when you say institutionalized and systemic racism, and then after that we're going to get into a little bit more about the history, and then we're going to cover many topics that are relevant to those three things. But when you say the history of racism and institutionalized racism, what are we talking about?
Well, the United States was built on the poison of racism right from the very start. And, beginning with the Jamestown settlement, and when the slave ships arrived there, and they, from there, you know, there was the stealing of the land and the wealth from the Native American peoples. That was all based on racism. Without a racist base, they never could have done all that. Then we had slavery in this country. Without racism, without the influence of racism, ideological, systemic, institutionalized racism, you know, slavery never could have existed. Ideological racism is one of the worst poisons that has ever entered, human existence. So, from there, from slavery, we had the capitalism developed, and the capitalists, they had to keep workers pitted against one another, and they used racism as their tool to do that, to divide working people. In other words, the capitalists understood that if working people ever got together, that would be the end of capitalism, and people would start building a socialist society working together. And the main thing that has divided working people in this country to this very day has been racism. And we see that in the trials of trial after trial and case after case, Oscar Grant, the murder by the police. My ex-wife, her son, was shot and killed while he was getting off of a school bus. He was 12 years old. In New York City, nothing was ever done to the police there. The police were involved in a shootout with a bunch of drug pushers. An innocent black youth, 12 years old, was killed getting off of his bus, school bus. You know, the racism just permeates everything in our society, and it's terrible.
Now, Alan, we have seen racism in capitalist societies. And we have actually seen it for thousands of years. We saw it back around the time of the Romans, where they used racism to pit one race against another, where when they brought in the slaves from many of the African countries and from many other parts of the world, but like they were inferior individuals to the Romans. And
right.
We saw the same thing with in Germany, where the Germans were saying that that the blacks were inferior and the Jews were inferior. So they used race, and what it did, what they did, is they, we could see that they pitted one group against another. So the history of racism, it runs pretty deep. It runs back thousands of years, and it's just been, we have seen it in one form or another from one government to another government for well over 2,000 years. Is this so?
Oh, sure. Every ruling class has used racism, and it's the worst poison that human society has ever created, as far as I'm concerned, because it just threatens everything. Racism is used to fight these wars. Racism is used to destroy democracy. Racism is used to destroy our standard of living. You know, we've been involved in struggles here in Minnesota for affirmative action. Affirmative action is the only means that's ever been found in this country to actually begin to right some of the wrongs in employment and in education and in housing, and yet the politicians don't even want to enforce affirmative action in this, at this point in time. You know, we have Obama, who's come to the presidency. Obama represents Wall Street's interest. What are Wall Street's interests? Continuing to make profits. They're, you know, then their greedy drive for profits. They use racism to reap super profits by dividing people. And, you know, it just goes on and on. And unless working people begin to understand what racism is meant to do to divide us, you know, we're in for some terrible things in this country. And we can see the Trayvon Martin murder. You know, that's the Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. These are some of the more well-known cases. But how many murders take place all across this country that are racist murders day in and day out? And the police are some of the biggest offenders, if not the main offenders, in all of this.
Right. And we see very often that they use racism as a means of diverting the public's attention from what the business of the state is. In other words, where you, and like I say, we can go back thousands of years, but as long as people are focused on those hot button issues, they forget all about what is taking place in government and what the rulers and the rulers in the capitalist communities, what they're doing to take away people's rights and the freedoms and to enslave them. They forget all about this.
Right.
And now you mentioned about one of the things that I look at this Zimmerman case, and you've seen it in other cases with Emmett Till back in the 50s when he was 14 years old and he was basically killed, but he still had a jury. His jury were basically people that were not his peers. And
right.
As I mentioned, you know, this happened in Mississippi years ago, but still it was part of the helped to launch the civil rights movement back then. But more recently, the people that can relate to would be, well, let's start with Zimmerman. When you look at a trial that they're preparing to have a trial and they select a jury process, many people, first of all, when they see the jury, once it's been selected, they already can see what's coming down the pipeline.
Sure.
Because
I think everybody knew.
Because
what was
the whole process is corrupt.
Yeah. And from top to bottom.
Let's face it, myself being black, I would hate if I was in a trial such as, you know, a criminal trial such as where murder or anything else that was that severe, that I'm looking at people that are not my peers, that they're all white, and I'm the only black person in the courtroom.
Right. I mean, even a traffic ticket, some people call it petty. I don't call anything that anybody gets arrested for petty myself.
No, it's not.
But when you have to sit there and you know that you're not getting a fair trial, I mean, what that does to a person is, you know, is just unbelievable. And these prosecutors and the police, that they have no compunction at all to go ahead and continue, you know, in trial after trial. Any, you know, here in northern Minnesota, I'll tell you, you can go into any courtroom in the city of Bemidji, and the courtrooms are packed, and the main defendants being brought into the courtroom are Native Americans, and everybody knows they're not getting a fair hearing. It's almost a joke among the prosecutor and the judges that there's going to be a conviction in every one of the cases, whether the people are guilty or not. And so when a Native American goes into court, they know they're going to be convicted, even
right,
though
exactly.
they're innocent. You know, and it, this goes on day in and day out, 365 days of the year. You know, how this continues, you know, if we don't have a totally racist society, this wouldn't be going on. I'm citing the city of Bemidji, and that's just one, you know, very small city in this country, but you can go to any city in this country and see the same thing. And day in and day out, this is what goes on in the courts, and it's just sheer racism. How else can it be explained? And yet they will say, the media will say to you, oh, these trials are fair, you know, it's justice. But everybody knows that if you're a person mm-hmm. of color, you know you're not getting any justice in this country.
Oh, no. No, it already starts out on the wrong foot. Let's look at Zimmerman when he was first, I shouldn't say in custody by the Sanford Police Department there in Florida, but when he went in for questioning by that department, they freely allowed him just to walk around the department with not being in cuffs or anything. Basically, he was like one of their own. And if this had been a black person, trust me, he wouldn't have been walking around with other police officers playing chummy.
No, he probably would
have. That's reality.
Yeah, I'm sure he would have been.
Oh, he would have gotten beat up first. You're correct.
Yeah. And
he would have gone to the police department in cuffs. And
sure.
He probably would not have left jail that night.
Maybe not ever have left jail alive either.
exactly.
Well, that's true.
Or if you turn it around, if it had been a black person instead of Zimmerman, if it had been turned the other way around, you're correct. He probably would not have even left jail at all.
Yeah. There's all kinds of so-called suicides taking place in the lockups and jails in this country, and you know that this many people can't be committing suicide in a jail cell. They have cameras and everything else, and yet there's dozens, literally dozens of so-called suicides that take place in these jails in this country. You know, how does that happen? It can't happen. These people are being murdered.
Right, and so what we see is, we see from, even from the point that you're just on the street, going to the jails, going to the courts, going to the prisons, we see the whole process is working against people based on their race. And we can clearly see that something wasn't, when we look at fairness, we can see what was taking place in this Trayvon Martin case and Zimmerman case. Something wasn't fair. Just because when you look at the procedure of what takes place in this country with blacks and a procedure that takes place with whites, it's not fair at all.
No, that's the institutionalized racist aspect of the whole entire court system. And how that's going to be dealt with, I don't know. But, you know, we tried to deal with it here in northern Minnesota, and the Civil Rights Division of the United States Department of Justice held a special meeting. And it was real interesting because one of the things that came up, it was all about racism against Native Americans. And people were detailing what was happening to them by the police. And the only thing that the Department of Justice could come up with, even though they admitted that the police were committing crimes against the people and committing these racist acts, the only thing they could come up with was to say the police need to be educated. I asked the question. I said, how come when the police commit the crimes against people, the police need to be educated, but when people commit crimes, they go to jail? I said, why aren't the police going, being prosecuted and being taken to jail? They're breaking the law. I told them, you're admitting it. The police are beating people up. The police are intentionally stopping people that shouldn't be stopped. Why aren't these police being dealt with as criminals? And,
right.
They didn't even want to...
Institutionalized.
Exactly. They didn't want to deal with that. All they could talk about was, well, the police have to be educated. Well, when somebody becomes a police officer, it's taken for granted that police officer is already educated, especially when it comes to matters of race. And for these cops, for the Department of Justice to admit and acknowledge that these crimes are taking place, being committed by police officers against the people, and then they come in and say, well, these police officers have to be educated. No, they should be prosecuted and they should be sent to jail, And this is why this continues to go on in this country, because the police think that they got free rein in committing all these racist acts. It's like a little racist society, every one of these police departments in this country. Even there's been cases where black police officers have been harassed by white police officers, and because the black police officers did not want to go along with the repression and the injustices that were being committed and carried out by these white police officers. The black police officers have been subjected to some of the most horrendous kinds of racist actions on the part of the white police. This goes on in police departments all across the country. Many good black police officers and police officers of color have been driven right out of the police departments in this country. They've had, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they were putting feces in the locker of a black police officer, a young black woman, because she objected to the racism of her fellow police officers. Stuff like this goes on all over this country.
Now, Alan, we can see much of what takes place with racism and the authorities. We see it. It's right out in the street. And then after that, we have this nonsense media in this country. Then they come and cover it, so they can add to all the distraction, so people won't know what's going on with the state. One of the cases that happened, this was back in the 90s, was Rodney King. And I think a lot of people are familiar with that case, that he should have stopped when he was being pursued by the police without running them all over Los Angeles County, but he didn't. But what took place when once he did stop, the whole world saw this, and he literally got the crap beat out of him. Three police officers, including one that was overseeing the beating. And subsequently, the not only in the county of Los Angeles, but nationwide and worldwide, we saw riots erupting, and then people were even more angered by the verdict, where they took to the streets in violence. Now, this is something again when you see what is taking place by the various police departments, after the beating, these police officers went to court in their Simi Valley community, which is an all-white community, and here's one black person, an all-white jury, and then they find these officers not guilty.
Right.
And then after they got the not guilty verdict, and of course they went out the courtroom, they were smiling and happy, but that's when all the violence erupted. But, Alan, what we can see here is that when you say institutionalized racism, the system is saying it's okay. He was black,
right,
and they were white, and they
right.
were police officers. But it's not okay because the public is trying to say we're not satisfied with this. But then the media comes, and then they just show that blacks are out in the street and they're rioting. And one of the things like I say, when you look at how institutionalized racism and how racism works, along with the media, Alan, then they didn't show all the white people out. They showed them for a day or so, and all of a sudden, all you could see out in the street were just blacks and Hispanics. But if you saw the night when it initially happened, as it started unfolding, you had everybody out in the streets.
That was the media.
The media actually focused the attention that, look what the blacks are doing.
Well, historically, this is the very sad situation with racism in this country, though. The only way racism has ever been dealt with is through violence. You had to have a civil war, a very gruesome and violent civil war to end slavery. If you go forward to the civil rights era under Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats never acted until the cities were literally burning. And then they came forward with the Civil Rights Act and affirmative action.
Exactly.
It's every single time. People have tried to reason with using logic to fight racism, for ever since the existence of this country. There were people that tried to use reason and logic to during the drafting of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to show that racism was at work and that it was an injustice, and people ignored that. You had slavery. Slavery was ignored for, many, many years until there was a violent and bloody civil war that put an end to it. All the while, people, we had religious people and all kinds of other people talking about the immorality of slavery and racism, and this has gone on and on. We have people writing books. How many books have been written about how and why racism is wrong and it's an injustice? And yet we have politicians that won't even listen to, what's being said. They won't even do anything about it. And the people they appoint won't do anything about it. So it gets to the point where people have to revolt, and you get this violence. And, Obama and the Democrats, they understood what the verdict was going to be in the Zimmerman trial. And that's why
they had
it all prepared. They had all these ministers lined up to start talking about, we need peace, and there shouldn't be no civil disturbance or anything in the streets. And they had this all lined up. They were working for months to try and make sure that there wasn't going to be any violence in response to the not guilty verdict. They knew the verdict was going to be not guilty. It was a foregone conclusion. Yeah. And that is the whole institutional crime of racism right there, that they knew that a murderer was going to go free, a guy that murdered a kid was going to go free, that a guy that murdered a kid because he was black was going to go free. They knew that was going to happen, so they made preparations to try and head off any violence. They were more concerned with heading off violence of people responding to the injustice than stopping the injustice itself that was taking place in the courtroom.
And I want to ask, Alan, do you know where someone like Zimmerman came up with the necessary funds, the amount of defense like that? Because usually when blacks run into a situation where they're on trial for their life, they have the public pretenders. And then you have someone like Zimmerman. He's got, he's got these big attorneys. Where did the financing come from for these attorneys?
Well, I think that's
because
one
blacks
thing that's
always
look
at, I say public pretenders, you know.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's really got to be discussed is where did he get the money and who was backing him, who wanted him to get off, and who was using this case to promote racism. He obviously nobody that the average person cannot afford a defense like Zimmerman had. I mean, we all know that.
Where
did this guy come get the money?
Somebody we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars.
To build this case. Yeah.
And these attorneys don't work for free.
No, probably millions of dollars. That's one thing that has to be found out. We were talking about this on Facebook the other day. Where was this money coming from? And, is it coming from big business? Because big business realized that the racism that was being generated would influence the politics of this country. And that's probably what happened. We have to find out where this money came from. And, you know, when most people go to court, you know, yeah, you talk about these public defenders, and they couldn't care less. All they want to do is get somebody to cop a plea so they can go off to jail for a couple of years instead of for 10 years or whatever. And they find them guilty and get them into the system. And once they're in the system, these people are locked in the system for life. You know, that's another part of the institutionalized racism. Even though you go free from jail, you know, you're treated like a second and third class citizen for the rest of your life once you're in the system.
But that's something, Alan, if you come up with something on that, I'm just very curious, where did Zimmerman come up with the big bucks to pay for a defense like that? And you could see that it was a certain amount of confidence. Matter of fact, Alan, I saw it right on the streets. Everyone was saying, like, not even 2 weeks into the trial, this guy's going to get off. You know, they could already see it. You know,
yeah. Obvious. They prepared. They knew that he was going to get off, and they were preparing for it. You know, people were telling me 2 and 3 months ago that religious leaders were being contacted in Minneapolis to hold services to, you know, pray for justice and to make sure that there wasn't going to be any civil disorder or anything, and to call for calm. You know, they knew the verdict that was coming down. It was just, you know, it was a foregone conclusion. And these people in power, they allowed the injustice to take place, and they wanted to prevent the people from having any say in opposition to the injustice. You know, this is the real racist crime of it all. And then the media jumps in and uses this to completely divide American society.
And what happens is, and like you say, being very institutionalized, where it spreads throughout the fibers of the whole country, because this spreads right into the workplace, where people can see that, you know, here's a black, he's doing something he should not do. He's coming from the store, he's got his tea and he's got his Skittles, but he shouldn't even be out there. But when people are looking at what takes place after that, what takes place in the street and the violence and like that, then the media comes and focus on the blacks that are in the street and whatever violence that will occur after that. In the various job places throughout the country, that has a lot to do with that interview process. Like, you know, here the interviewer, they just looked at this on television last night, and now they're up here interviewing people for jobs. What do you think, Alan? I mean, that's just a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, the conclusion is that black people won't be hired for jobs either.
Exactly,
and,
because they're violent people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the image that's always been created. Whether it was Nat Turner's rebellion or people fighting for just common human decency, the right to be able to drink out of the same drinking fountain or use the same bathroom, the image that's always been portrayed is people of color, and black people especially, are violent people. And, you know, it's the police dogs and the water cannons and everything else was always so supposedly justified because these cops were dealing with people that were supposedly inherently violent. And this is part of the institutionalized racism and the historic racism that exists in our society. And it really hasn't changed all that much from the 30s and 40s in this country to what we have today. Possibly it's even worse today than it was, 50, 60 years ago. Because now we're at a situation where people should know better, and what's being done is being done intentionally. The racism that exists is, the people have been intentionally educated to be these racists because society needs that, you know. And this is what makes it so pernicious. You have people saying, they'll tell you to the, you know, government officials, police chiefs, people in city governments and county governments and state governments, they will tell you to your face, oh, we're not racist. And, you know, they're going back with their friends and they're laughing that, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. This is the way it works, you know.
Today we have Alan. I want to thank you again for joining the program. Today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again. And today we're talking about institutional and systemic racism, the tool for capitalism. And we're going to get a little bit more into how it's a tool for capitalism, because basically we live in a very racist society, and it's very class-based. And it affects blacks, Hispanics, when we see many of the laws that take place. Right now, Congress, for the last 40 years, they've been discussing how they're going to protect the border. And this president today, he has his administration working on how they're going to enforce the border. And many of the problems that we see with the border has been created by this government. With many of our trade policies that we have, even with NAFTA. But, Alan, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alan, I want to get your opinion. What are your ideas about the Stand Your Ground laws that they have? Right now, there's, I think it's 25 states that have Stand Your Ground laws. Florida was the first state that had a Stand Your Ground law. But what is your opinion about this law?
Well, if you're white, you can stand your ground. If you're black, you can't. And that's the reality of it, and that's what these laws are, all racist laws, these stand your ground laws.
Because that's what it seemed like it boils down when I understand my limited understanding of stand your ground. You know, self-defense or, you know, when you're on the streets, that you can go on the attack, but if you're black, you can't.
No, and, you know, I believe in self-defense, too. I think most people do. But the simple fact of the matter is that these stand-your-ground laws are being instituted to appease the racist, and that's what it's all about. And, you know, if you look at all these the gun laws and everything else, you know, who is even able to get guns legally in this country? They give the racist the guns. And, you know, go and if you're a felon or been convicted of a crime, go try and get a gun to protect yourself, you know, when you get out of prison, and you're not going to get a gun. If you get a gun, it'll have to be a gun that you get illegally. And, you know, the whole thing about gun registration and everything else, it's you got the National Rifle Association backing all these things. And the National Rifle Association is a very racist organization right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all being used to appeal to the racist. You know, I was at Democratic Party meetings where they talked about we have to support these stand-your-ground type laws in order to appeal to the gated people that are living in the gated communities and in suburbia. And that's what this is all about. It's all about racism. It's divide and conquer, and it's as simple as that.
Well, Alan, let's face it, stand your ground. If, you know, in these states, some states, including Florida, you know, you can have, it can be a concealed weapon or you have the weapon out and open, but stand your ground, you can be able to confront someone, and it's supposed to be in self-defense. But let's face it, Zimmerman, he probably didn't have much to worry about if he was stopped by a police officer on the street, you know, to protect himself. But let's face it, if a black is on the street with a concealed weapon or one in open, more than likely he's going to get the crap beat out of him.
Sure.
Or her.
Well, I think
everybody reality.
I think everybody in this country understands if Trayvon Martin would have killed Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin would have been justified under stand your ground. And yet we all know that Trayvon Martin would not have gone free like Zimmerman did.
No.
You know,
already know that. We don't need to wait for the jury. We don't need to wait for the judge. Alan, we already know that.
Yeah. And it's just like there was a woman that was on trial about the same time because she was abused, so she fired a couple warning shots into a wall.
And that's what we were going to talk about right now was Marissa Alexander.
Yeah, she's going to prison for 20 years, and all she did is shoot some holes in a wall in order to try and intimidate the person that was trying to attack her. And, you know, so you see the kind of justice she's getting compared to what Zimmerman got. And she's not getting, you know, these attorneys that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars either.
And the prosecutor
is prosecuting her more viciously than that they prosecuted Zimmerman.
Right. And one of the things that's very interesting, Alan, when you look at battered women, and many of these women, they have the history of that, of those families, is where they have been beaten and battered verbally and physically, and many of these women, they have killed in self-defense, and they end up going to prison. Many of these women have had restraining orders, and the restraining orders, it was nothing more than a piece of paper, and the woman still went to prison. But when we talk about stand your ground, it's like it doesn't apply to, you know, that doesn't apply to women needing to protect themselves, or black women or white women. But it's, we have double standards here.
For sure.
That need to be addressed.
I've been told by people that work with women in the prisons here in Minnesota that close to 70% of the women are in prison because they were defending themselves against abuse.
And I can relate to that firsthand, because even my sister, she is now divorced from her abusive husband, but he was threatening to kill her. I mean,
yeah.
You know, many people were aware of his threats. And, I mean, not only did he beat her, but, you know, where he confined her in her home and would not allow her to go to work, would not allow her to drive. He would go, when she would go out in public, he would go and pick her up and take her back home against her will. And this was going on repeatedly. And every time it came up with the authorities, they say, well, you know, if we see some blood or some broken bones, then we're going to take action. But, Alan, by the time it gets to that, the person's dead.
Exactly. And
so, I mean, when we talk about stand your ground, and we go get back to Marissa Alexander, and a lot of people need to be aware of what has taken place with this woman, because this woman, basically, she just fired a shot in the air. I mean, it wasn't even pointed. She didn't even point a weapon at her ex-husband, at her husband, at the time. I believe it was her husband. And she still went, she was arrested, went to court, and received 20 years in prison.
Yep.
Now, this is happening to women, not only just in Florida. This, I might mention, it happened in Florida, where the Stand Your Ground laws applied to Zimmerman. But we can see it was very unfair when it came to Marissa Alexander. And this is
right.
Something that, you know, a case that I've been standing on top of. I mean, no relationship to me, but I'm looking at the unfairness of this system. And again, it comes down to what's been institutionalized in this country when it comes to racism.
Yeah, and her case is something that's just considered like normal all across this country. You know, women are going to prison for doing the exact same thing, similar thing that what she did, and it's the Justice Department. You know, we're supposed to have a Department of Justice that's supposed to be investigating taking action.
Did you say justice?
Justice.
Okay.
Injustice. That's what it really is. You know, a lot of people, I've gone to court and myself and been bailed people out and stuff, and people, the first thing they do when they come to the courtroom is say, this is the court of injustice. And
right.
If you talk to most people around the courtrooms, that's what you'll find they have to say. Most people recognize if they do something wrong, that you know, that they're gonna there's gonna be consequences. But so many people, they haven't. The police just go after them, and they're looking for somebody to convict of a crime because it's they gotta blame somebody, and. They're taking people to court, and they're putting people in jail that are totally innocent. And we see this all the time. People, after they spend 10, 15, 20 years in jail, are let out after they've been proven that they didn't even commit the crime. And so, you know, how many cases are there like this, but it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to mount a defense to get somebody out of jail once they've been convicted. And you have all these people. The only reason they're in jail is because they can't afford the kind of attorneys that
they can't afford. And one of the other things, Alan, you have to realize, many of these persons that are in jail, they haven't found them guilty. I mean, they can't find any charges that will stick against those individuals. So subsequently, they ask those individuals, many minorities, to plea bargain to crimes that they haven't even committed. We see this every day.
The public defenders, that's all they're for, is to plea bargain. I mean, that's their whole job, is what it amounts to, is to work out plea bargains. And the plea bargains, the whole thing behind the plea bargains is to get people in the system. And once they get people in the system, they never get out of it. You know, there's no way out of it for people.
Now, we can see how this creates an opportunity for many, well, it's a disadvantage to minorities, blacks and Hispanics, when it comes to jobs, because people are the television creates a very powerful impression when people see that. And many of these employers are looking at the same thing. And subsequently, when people see this, that's all they have their focus on. But I want to focus on a couple of things that have been in the news. And one of the things we have heard nothing on because of this Zimmerman trial. I might mention on headline news, they were almost covering the Zimmerman trial 24/7. I mean, you could watch it. You could turn your television on at 3 o'clock in the morning, and here they were talking about the Zimmerman trial. Alan, there's a lot of other things going on that we should know about living in this country other than just one trial. But people watch these things like they're a soap opera.
Exactly, and that's why they do it.
In the Bradley Manning, I just want you to speak a little bit about the Bradley Manning case, because that's going on right now. But that's very significant why people should know about that. They need to know about Edward Snowden and what was taking place with that. And as a result of the Zimmerman case, have you heard anything about what's going on with Snowden?
No, it's they used the Zimmerman case to cover up everything that's being done. I mean, that was the intent. So that's
right.
Why they sensationalized the racist aspect of it, to get people preoccupied and to get their minds off of the real problems in this country. And
and I might mention the Bradley Manning case trial. A lot of people may be aware of that. I know it's a lot that you see on Facebook, various Twitters in regards to Bradley Manning, people saying, "I am Bradley Manning." But people need to understand that what has taken place in this country, the secrecy and the way our freedoms are being lost and the invasion of privacy, that this Bradley Manning trial is very important to many millions of Americans. And basically what this case has to do with is about many of the classified documents that were released through WikiLeaks. But Alan, these are things, and what we see with Edward Snowden, these are things that people need to know what is taking place in this country that's affecting our rights and our freedoms and how we're being spied on as citizens and as people living in this country. And the media is not even covering this.
No, the attacks on democracy are closely related to the racist attacks that are taking place. And the more racism you have in a country, the more pervasive the racism, the greater the attacks are going to be on democracy in general. And I think that's one reason why we're seeing in the Bradley Manning case and the Snowden case, where Obama has, especially the Snowden case, where he's used the Espionage Act again, and they're getting away with this. And then they're going after the countries. If you look at the countries they're going after that have said that they consider giving him asylum, most of these countries are countries where people of color are in control, and so they're going after these governments. They've attacked the Venezuelan government. They've attacked the Bolivian government.
Bolivia. Bolivian government.
Yep, and they're attacking all these.
Actually, they hijacked the president's Morales. He hijacked his private jet.
Yeah, a blade.
Hijacked.
Just like pirates in the air, you know. And
detain a president of a country, detain him, search his plane, and basically it was piracy, air piracy.
Yeah, you can be sure they wouldn't do that to the Queen of England.
Oh, no.
And they wouldn't have even done it to Putin. But they picked a person of color to do this to. And I don't think that that's coincidental. You know, it's part of the whole imperialist scheme of things that where racism is an important part of that.
And you have to realize when we're talking about institutionalized racism, we're talking about this on a national and international scale, not just when it relates to certain trials or what take place in various governments. But we can see, Alan, that this actually... this is in not only our courts, but we see the way that institutionalized racism is right there in Congress itself. We can see what the laws that they make is racist, the laws, the way that they dismiss certain laws that have been put on the books and the way that they have dismissed certain parts of the Civil Rights Act, the way that they dismiss various affirmative action programs. This is institutionalized racism on a national level.
Right. The fact alone that they won't enforce affirmative action, which is the law of the land, tells you a great deal of what's going on in this country. You know, there's nobody that could go down the street speeding, and if they were stopped by a cop and they said, oh, you know, what difference does it make if I go 50 miles in a 30-mile-hour zone? The person's going to get a ticket. But here you have affirmative action, which is the law of the land, and even the president of the United States won't order his own Department of Justice to enforce it. You know, this is a very selective enforcement of the laws of the land, and they selectively decide not to enforce affirmative action, even when they know that the levels of poverty are rising to extreme limits in communities of people of color, you know, and the reason for that is because of racist employment practices to begin with, and then the government won't enforce affirmative action to help create the level playing field, which affirmative action is there to do. So you have the government itself ignoring its own laws, you know.
Ellen, are we going backwards as a nation?
Yeah, we're going way back, and, you know, there doesn't seem to be any end to it unless people start to stand up. You can see what's happening in North Carolina. These Republicans there are just going after every single piece of legislation that has been in place to help people in any way possible, and they're just going totally on the attack, and people are being arrested left and right. Hundreds of people have been arrested for protesting. Now, if that was, you know, some of these Pat Robertson groups and stuff that were protesting in state capitals, those people would never be arrested on the scale that they're being arrested on in North Carolina today. That's another aspect of racism. And, you know, the first laws that these Republicans went after were the civil rights laws, the voting rights laws. You know, totally racist. That's where they started. And now they're going after everybody else. You know, people sat in silence as they attacked voter rights laws. They sat in silence as they attacked civil rights legislation there in North Carolina. And now they're going after everybody. And that's the way these people operate. They start with their racist campaigns against people of color, and then gradually they go after the rest of the working people. And by
right,
the
exactly.
time that they go after everybody, people are so divided and fighting themselves that they can't, they can no longer unite and get together to fight the people that are doing this to them. You know, the people in power, the very wealthy.
Alan, we're going to focus a little bit on the prison industrial complex, because we realize we have more people in jails and prisons in this country than they have in China. And
yeah,
the prison industrial complex is a multi-billion dollar industry, especially here in California. Alan, just share with us a little bit of the problems that we have with a system that we have in this country where it is based on incarceration.
Well, just to begin with, when a person is arrested in many communities in this country now, you're forced to pay a booking fee. You're forced to pay for the time that you spend in jail, even though you haven't been convicted of anything. They charge you a board and room fee. So before you even go to court, you've got this huge bill you have to pay, and you'll probably never be able to pay it since you're there, because you're poor to start with. You haven't been able to afford the bond to get out. So, you know, even if you get sentenced to 30 days or you get a fine, you still got this huge bill to pay for spending time in jail, and they charge you for the food you eat. So it starts right off the bat. And then they get you into the system. And if you go to jail, try and get a job when you get out, and you can't. You know, you've got a stigma attached to you that you'll never get a job that amounts to anything. And then, you know, if you stay in jail for the long term, all they do is use you there for cheap labor. And
right,
there's corporations that are, you know, using people in prison to do their work. And they pay them literally, you know, nothing to do that, where they would have to pay somebody even, you know, the minimum wage, which is pitiful to start with. But they're getting prisoners to do all this for, you know, free. And it's literally slave labor. And you've got, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people doing this kind of labor in the prison system in this country now. And they call it part of prison reform, you know. It would be one thing.
Well,
if
we have
2.5 million
people in prison in,
yeah,
in the
it
jails.
It would be one thing if they were training people to do jobs, knowing that people were going to get jobs in those trades when they get out of prison. But this isn't the case at all. The people are not getting any jobs when they get out of prison, and they're forced into a life of poverty. And chances
right,
are they're going to go back into crime because they got no other alternative. You know, this is the kind of vicious cycle that people are being caught up in. And it's a cycle that's not going to end until people put an end to it.
If you look at Los Angeles, the overcrowding taking place in Los Angeles jails, this was the statistics here a little bit outdated, like by around 3 years or so, but there were 171,000 people, 171,000 inmates in the Los Angeles County Jail. Within a period of a year, and the population was close to 19,000 at any given time. 19,000 people incarcerated. Most of these people that are incarcerated are Hispanics and Blacks.
Yep.
Looking at these prisons, they're not whites. And also, when you look at the U.S. prison population, you look at the U.S. prison population, which is well over 218,000 inmates in the federal prisons. But Alan, this is a problem here, especially when you look at California State. If you go back several years ago, now they're just under 170,000 in the state prisons here in California. 170,000, and a federal judge is calling for them to even reduce that by another 30,000. When you consider the cost at $43,000 per inmate per year, $43,000 just to keep
yeah,
them in jail. Right.
Yeah, they could
Alan,
be giving people good jobs. And
good,
people,
$43,000. They'd rather incarcerate someone, pay for these new facilities and expensive facilities, and this is how much they're paying to incarcerate them. There's a problem. You can see that the whole system is intrinsically racist. Ellen,
yeah,
it was something I mentioned some time ago when you looked at the death row here in California, which I am extremely opposed to, you know, the death sentence for anyone. But they had looked at people that had been executed. Los Angeles Times had posted this at the time that Stanley Tookie Williams, when he was executed in 2006. But it was estimated that it was $225 million for the time that a person, for their appeals, the incarceration, for each individual, the 11 people up to Stanley Tookie Williams that had been incarcerated, it was on an average of $225 million to pay for each individual on death row. I might mention it's close to 800 individuals on death row in California, not to mention that Texas, they lead the nation in executions. So when you look at the prison industrial complex in this country, Alan, there's a problem. And again, we're looking at institutionalized racism on a statewide and a national level that is costing working people billions of dollars.
Yeah. You know, even the telephone calls are a racket in the prisons. You talk for a couple of minutes and it costs you $20. You know, everything in the prison system is a racket today. There's no, you know, no attempt to really reform the judicial system. There's no attempt to get people so that they have jobs. And, you know, this is what it's all about, getting people, you know, jobs, because if you get people jobs, they're not involved in any criminal activity. But yet they'll spend all this money on the prison system, and it's only because somebody's making a whole lot of money off of the prison system that they're doing this. The more people they put in jail, the more these people are making money. Left and right, they're making money off of room and board. They're making money off of telephone calls. They're making money off of the bonds. You know, this is a huge, huge profit-making complex that we have with the prison system in this country today, and that's why so many people are going to prison.
I just want to ask you, we can see that we have multiple problems. Is there any turning the tide and trying to make things right? I mean, what can we do to – we can see that we have major problems when it comes to racism in our courts, in our prisons, our jails, in the job place, in our Congress. But is it too late to turn the tide?
Well, it'll never be too late as long as there's human life. But the thing is, when it comes to racism, whether it's in the prison system or the courts, a lot of it is just peer pressure prevents people from speaking out against this racism. And people are going to have to take the initiative to speak out against racism when they see it and where they see it. Otherwise, you know, there isn't a lot of hope that we're going to be able to change things. So,
well, Alan, we have one more minute. I'd just like for you to have make a close your last words from this and then give your contact information. And as always, we appreciate you coming on, and we appreciate Ruth Ann Martafio for sponsoring this program. Alan, what are your last words from this today?
Well, I just hope that more people will begin to speak out against racism, and that the people will begin to see that how racism is connected to these wars and unemployment and the general deterioration of our society and our standard of living. And unless we speak out against racism, we're not going to be able to unite and get people together to take care of our other problems. That's the bottom line. This racism is dividing people, and we've got to overcome that.
And how can people reach you, Alan?
They can call me at 218-386-2432. Or they can just Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll come across my blog, and all my contact information is there.
Alan, again, I'd like to extend my appreciation that you joined our program once again, and I look forward to having you to join our program 2 weeks from now. Thanks again, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. See you next week.
Stuart.
You're welcome.
Using ancient techniques taught by our ancestors, we express the spirit of tradition from cultures all across the planet. We blend by hand and we create with light and intention for use, using fragrance and subtle essences to awaken your sensuality, both physical and subtle, all for the mystical exploration of you. DaughtersofIsis.com. Come find us.
Welcome to the Research
Rabbit
Hole.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. You're on the air.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole with Cynthia Hamill. Tonight we have Ron Patton, the publisher of Paranoia Magazine, that just hosted the Paranoia Con conference in San Diego this past weekend, and a well-known author of the Mothman series, Andy Colvin. Welcome to you both.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah,
hello.
Great to have you, Ron. And Andy.
Yeah.
Well, it was a wonderful conference.
It was a great time. We had, we had about 15 or 20 people, not a huge crowd, but it was an intimate setting. And as you well know, the speakers were excellent. Had some really good information to pass along.
Totally. It was incredible. And I feel like it's one of my very favorite conferences because you could actually meet people and talk with the speakers and get to know everybody there. It was incredible. Great experience.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. So can you kind of go back over the speakers that talked, where people can hear their name and know what they've been writing and what they've been working on, because there were some fabulous researchers there, and it would be great to have you explain, you know, each person and what they were doing. I mean, I attended it, but I don't know the details that you do.
Well, I'll kind of give a rough sketch of, you know, some of the speakers. There are 9 altogether. And, again, it was a two-day event from 11 to 7 over at Café Sobaca, which was a great venue, I thought, for what we were trying to put on.
It was perfect.
Excellent beer. And we started off Saturday with a good friend of mine by the name of Lennon Honor. And Lennon is out of Hemet, California. And he's a family counselor, sort of a motivating speaker. He goes to various schools and all kinds of different places to stir people up to maybe think a little bit differently outside the box. And his presentation was 9/11 Fear-Based Mind Control. And essentially what that had to do was sort of like what's occurred after 9/11, sort of the post 9/11 psyche of Americans, and how many people, you know, because of that event, now become really like scared or just feel depressed anytime there's a traumatic event that occurs, whether it's something like Sandy Hook, you know, the shootings there at the elementary school back on the East Coast, or the Boston Marathon bombing. We've become more and more, you know, desensitized. And what Lennon does is he tries to show us what the media actually does in creating this fear-based mind control programming, and what we can do to mitigate or offset it in terms of, you know, self-empowerment and being able to read between the lines. So what were your thoughts about Lennon, Andy?
Well, it's funny because his work is paralleled a lot of the stuff I've been doing the last 2 or 3 years or even 5 years,
I've been looking at the calendar and following the order of things and figuring out a pattern to all of this. And I have a lot of psychological background, sociology background, and in grad school. So, and I've sort of put together some ideas about what they're doing at a subliminal level.
Right.
And so, you know, again, I thought he had some tremendous insight into the subject matter. It was information that you don't readily hear, you know, from other sources. So
yeah, I really liked it.
Good, good. And I think the crowd was, they were really into it as well. It was like they were really surprised. Because, you know, he's, what I really wanted to try to do is to have a few speakers or presenters that may have not been heard about, but I know them personally, and some have just sort of been behind the scenes. Some are just upcomers, you know, who are starting to write books. But I think everybody was able to provide something that was a little bit different. I think each speaker, you know, brought to the table something very unique and something very profound. And of course, Mr. Andy Colvin, who's hanging out with me for a few days along with his son Gibb. And Andy, of course, is known as the Mothman photographer. And, you know, he talked about some of the Mothman stuff that has pretty much encompassed a lot of his life. And he got in sort of the synchronicities, but he also got into the human aspect of sort of like what goes on within ourselves. So, and can you kind of get sort of a synopsis of what you talked about?
Well, I told my basic story about how I lived in this area where Mothman was seen several times and sort of in different guises, and how one of the kids that lived there had said that he had had a vision of what would happen in 2001, and it was an attack on New York City that would cause World War III. And this was, you know, in the late 60s. And once 911, sorry, actually happened, that I realized that there was really something to the precognitive phenomenon that revolves around Mothman. And so I spent the next 10 years filming everybody I could find that still lived around there. And 33-hour, I guess it's almost a reality series. It's very similar to a series that Dean Haglund's put together with the Truth Is Out There, where it's not as stilted as a lot of the big programs. You know, there's a lot of impromptu stuff, and you film a lot more of the stuff than you normally would that sometimes gets edited out, but it's really interesting, where you're driving the things that the researchers say to each other in those in-between moments, and also with the witnesses too. And so I talked some about that, and then I talked about a couple of books I've been putting together about John Keel, or his work actually, collections of his old articles, which shed a lot of light on the UFO phenomenon even today, because so much of his work was suppressed, but at the same time it was co-opted by a lot of other different researchers. And so memes like the ancient aliens and the breakaway civilization, the terrestrial 4D theory, those are things that Keel came up with, and also his coverage of the Men in Black. And a lot of that stuff is still being used today, but no one really, he's sort of like Tesla. He's like the Tesla of the paranormal world, you know, sort of a genius who really figured out a lot of stuff way before everyone else. In fact, so far ahead that he was, you know, rejected in some manner, but he has a lot of, a legion of fans out there. And I think these books are going to be a very good addition to what's going on today. And I also talked about my experience here staying with Ron, and how one of his roommates is highly psychic and has an array of things that really relate to what John Keel was talking about or wanted to do with his writing, was to help people who have extremely paranormal experiences deal with them and understand what's going on. And one thing I will say before passing it back is, just today, Ron's roommate, Blanco is his name, saved us from the theft of a box of expensive material that Ron had taken to the conference. And like Blanco just had a feeling that something was wrong, and he walked out and found these guys stealing stuff from Ron's car. And so it's a really great ability that he has, and he's actually using it for good.
All righty. Shall I move along?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, so those were the first two speakers of the day. And then we had a good friend of mine, and also he's written for Paranoia, on the issue of transhumanism and artificial intelligence. And he's Siddiqui Bakare out of Los Angeles. And Siddiqui's, I consider him a true visionary. He's an author, columnist, human rights advocate. He's written several books. His latest one is Magnum Opus on Sacred Spiritual Technology. And he's written a book on wormholes, cybernauts, and holographic gods. And another book called Is a Computer Software the New God? Cyber Consciousness and Cybernetics in the Epic of Spiritual Transmigration Interface. So a lot of heady stuff. But again, I thought he did an excellent job in articulating and explaining some very sophisticated and deep subjects in very concise way for people to understand. So what was your thought on Siddiqui?
Me? I thought he did a fabulous job. And, of course, transhumanism is at the end of the research rabbit hole. With the chemtrail phenomena, people are wondering why they're getting Morgellons disease and, why they're having psychotronic weapons attacks and stuff like that. And all of this is, partially due to because they're creating a semi-robotic society, and like transhumanism, a blending of robotics and the human, species. So his information was really cutting edge, and he had some great slides and did a great job, interacting with the audience and getting their feedback. So he did a fabulous job. I was really impressed with all your speakers. All of them did a fabulous job.
Right. And the interesting thing about some of the information he was talking about pretty much segues into another one of my writers by the name of Elisa. And she is an MKUltra survivor, and she's written a few articles. She's actually publishing a book called Beyond MKUltra. And so she's, for years, talked about this type of stuff, but in regard to, like, hybrid cloning or what she refers to as human-alien genetic manipulation. And at the time, I used to think, oh, come on, give me a break. but more and more, it sounds more plausible just because there are more independent researchers, independent from one another, that are kind of saying the same thing. And it really puts into question our origins. Where did we really come from? And so there's a lot of historical texts and holy texts, even within the Holy Bible in the book of Genesis, some other places, where it talks about the Nephilim and these certain giants, these certain men of renown who, interbred with the women of the planet Earth. And, I mean, it's kind of weird when you read about it, in the Bible, but, maybe there's something to this. And there's a good book. What's the name? I think it's called The Cosmic Conspiracy by I.D.E. Thomas. And I read it years ago when I was putting together an article called Demons and Aliens Clothing. And he does a really good job of looking at the Bible and sort of in a non-biased way, but kind of saying, hey, maybe we are genetic manipulation, you know. Maybe we all have a little bit of human, a little bit of alien within us. So I think, again, this is something that we're really just touching upon, and there's going to be more and more evidence. And I think scientifically a lot of this stuff is coming into fruition as well. You know, if, like I tell people, if you can prove the technology exists and what the motivation is behind it, it's most likely already happening. So that's just how I felt about, you know, Siddiqui's talk, very insightful. And then at 5 o'clock, our last presenter for the day was Adam Gorightly, who kind of did the spoken word, talked about tales of conspiracy and high weirdness. And I'm trying to think of his friend, his musician friend. Was it Joe? Yeah, Joe. I thought they did a great job. They were playing like this crazy, you know, psychedelic conspiracy type music, but I thought it was a great way to end the day, you know, to kind of loosen things up a little bit. And then afterwards, you know, some of us got together and got to talk to one another, and, you know, I think a lot of people bonded quite well together. Would you
agree?
Yeah,
I think the size of the group was incredible, just because it allowed you to really, you know, get to know the people that were there. And I think everyone got a good chance to talk to all the speakers and everything, where normally they're kind of like a little bit removed and you can't interact with them as easily. So I thought it was really effective that way. It was really incredible.
Yes, very much so. And then the next day, we did things a little bit differently. We kind of changed up the room a little bit differently, and I had a little bit more energy. I wasn't really feeling on top of my game the day before, but I rebounded, and we got things rolling with Olaf Phillips. And Olaf talked about the secret Nazi space race. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see his presentation, so I don't know a lot about what he had to say, because I was sort of going in and out of the restaurant, you know, trying to sell tickets and then go back in and kind of listen up somewhat. But I know he did touch upon, you know, what the Nazis have been up to, you know, since post-World War II. And a lot of times people say, well, what about Nazis? There's no more Nazis. Well, there's a lot of Nazi influence within a lot of very top secret type of organizations, whether that's NASA or some of the different Department of Defense agencies. And, you know, the Nazis, a lot of those Nazis were brought into the United States, you know, through Project Paperclip right after World War II. They were funneled through the Vatican and through South America, and they kind of waited out a little bit, and then they came into the U.S., and they were very, very involved in starting up, like, the CIA and, of course, NASA with Wernher von Braun, their poster child, right?
Yeah.
Most all Americans know about him, but they don't know about some of the other people and some of the other scientists that were involved in some of the very top secret programs. And so Olaf touched upon Alternative 3, that movie that was made back, I think, in 1977. And, you know, it, very controversial to the extent where it was actually banned in several countries, but it gave various types of scenarios regarding, you know, the plight of the earth, you know, in terms of if a natural disaster or unnatural disaster occurred, where are the people going to go? And so it gave the three alternatives I would highly recommend people to kind of look that up, and I believe you can watch that online, Alternative 3, so check that out. But he also had quite a bit of information. He was able to back up. We also had sort of a, I would consider a conspiracy icon, and that's Ralph Epperson. Now, Ralph has been around for quite a long time. He's been studying conspiracy for over 50 years. He's written the book called The Unseen Hand, which has to do with the conspiratorial view of U.S. history, which was his the topic of his presentation. And then he wrote a follow-up book called The New World Order, which had, you know, more information in showing how things have been manipulated, whether it be economically or through religion and just through other social changes throughout the United States. He also got into, like, false flag operations to some extent, but I know that he really touched upon the whole monetary system, the whole economic system of the United States, and the reason why we're in so much debt today. And I thought he laid it out really well. It was a really excellent outline for people to understand why we're in the financial or the economic position we are today. So do you have any comments regarding Mr. Epperson's presentation?
I was actually getting ready to do my speech and was out having coffee, kind of ramping up during most of that. I didn't actually get a chance to hear him because I was on right after that. But maybe Andy does. Maybe Andy saw it.
Andy is predisposed right now.
Oh, okay.
He's back. What do you think about Uncle? I like to call him Uncle Ralphie because I've known Ralph for a long time, and it's like we're good friends, so... Jokingly, I just call him Grandpa or Uncle Ralphie. So what's your perspective on Uncle Ralphie?
Well, I only saw, you know, about the first half. I didn't see the, you know, the climax of the of his presentation. I'm familiar with, you know, what he does. And I did hear some interesting debates that were going on outside after with Ralph. Having to do with whether or not there's a heavy Jewish contingent in the financial world, which, if I were to give my opinion, I'd say there's some there, but it's the Anglo-Saxon groups that tend to dominate banking, at least, you know, in relation to our economy. But you know, he's like Ron said, he's an icon, and he's a bit of a codger. But we need to have a few codgers here and there. So,
all righty, yeah. Again, I think Ralph has written some very classic books, sort of one of a kind. And again, The Unseen Hand, I'd highly recommend for any conspiracy researcher to have in their library. And actually, you know, they can check out his website, and he's selling those books at a very reasonable rate. So, you know, go check it out. It's much cheaper to get it through him than Amazon.com. So,
what was his website information, Ron?
It's ralph-epperson.com.
Okay.
Epperson. But he's written other books, and I also talked briefly when I introduced Ralph yesterday to the audience that I'm a fifth cousin, allegedly, of Jesse James. And when I was younger, my great grandmother used to tell me that her husband Emmett James remembers when Jesse used to come to their house when he was a little boy back in the late 1800s and like in the late 1890s or whatever. But you know, I knew the so-called real history in that Jesse James allegedly got shot in the back, I think it was like in 1885, by John Ford when he was hanging up a picture, and he was supposedly shot dead. But my grandmother, my great-grandmother would just laugh, and she'd go, "Ronnie, that's all just make-believe. He pretended he got killed." And I'd ask, "Well, how come?" And she would just say, "Well, he had a lot of things he had to do," or, you know, something like that. And I don't know, it just didn't make sense to me. Then back in the mid-80s, I actually read something by Ralph Epperson. That's how I first found out about him. And he was doing some investigation about the staged or fake death of Jesse James.
Wow.
And how he supposedly staged his death in order to work in a more clandestine way with a group called the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was sort of a post-Civil War subversive clandestine group that wanted to kind of continue the Civil War, but more in a subversive way, you know, to try to get back the South. And so he was working, I mean, this is documented, he was working with Albert Pike, who was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry during the time, and he's also, he's written Morals and Dogma, which is, you know, the book for Scottish Rite Freemasons, and Albert Pike also founded the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. So what Jesse James was doing is he was like getting robbing banks and doing all kinds of other nefarious activities to get money to help finance or bankroll the Knights of the Golden Circle and to help out his fellow Masonic brother, Albert Pike. And then there's one other character that comes into play in all this, and his name is Brigham Young, who was the, you know, the second prophet after Joseph Smith in the Mormon Church, and he's the one that actually came out to establish the LDS Church in Salt Lake City. And he, too, was part of the Order of the Golden Circle. And so you have three of these strange bedfellows, Brigham Young, Jesse James, and Albert Pike, part of the same organization and collaborating to some extent. But I hope to do an article on that some future point in time. But anyway, that's a little sidetrack, but that's how I got to know Ralph Epperson, and so we've been really good friends ever since.
Cool. That's a great story. Very good. Yeah, that's very neat.
Yeah, and let's see. To continue on, we had, what's her name? God, I can't think of her name. She's blonde.
Me.
Very attractive woman. Cynthia Hamill.
Well, that's sweet of you.
And her presentation dealt with electronic harassment along with targeted individuals. And Cynthia, maybe you can provide the listeners with a synopsis of what you discussed yesterday, and along with the person who was also there with you.
Yes. I actually put everything on blogspot.com and was up 3 solid days almost. Like, I think I had 4 hours of sleep within that 3 days before doing this, in order to document everything and get it online where people could find my research and find where I was drawing all the stuff and have the links and the videos and all that. So you can actually go to the Research Rabbit Hole, WHOLE, like we spell the radio show, .blogspot.com. And you can see all of the headings that I have, and the whole basic speech starts at what chemtrails really are under targeted individuals and microwave warfare. So I was trying to tie in chemtrails with what they're doing with directed energy weapons and how they're actually able to target individuals and to attack them via the new technologies of microwave technology and psychotronic weapons, which Dr. Robert Duncan brings up in his book called Project Soul Catcher. So You know, I started off with that, and then we covered a lot of different things based on illustrations that I had brought in of, like, you know, Nikola Tesla. We even did a video on Tesla explaining his background and how all of his work with scalar energies and different electromagnetics ties in with this concept. And then we brought in the article by Carolyn Williams Palette, which is on Rents.com, called What Chemtrails Really Are. And that was the first thing in my research that cued me in that chemtrails were linked with directed energy weapons and the ability to target individuals and or groups with directed energy weapons. And then I tied that in with a fly swatter video, which is right underneath that in that same blog thread, and showed the video, and then you know, did a couple of illustrations on the fly zapper, and then leading into a target illustration showing a dartboard where all the darts are aimed at the center, and then that's called a target, right? And then we move into the era where you're actually targeting individuals, and I have a picture of an artist drawing the first parts of a target board, and she's actually in the center of the target. So we're moving into an era where people are literally able to be targeted based on their own infrared body heat pattern, and how these technologies can psychotronically tune in and torture somebody with remote neural monitoring 24/7. So that was the basic premise of the first part of my thing. And then we went into a video on with Rumsfeld, where we got it straight from the horse's mouth in a press conference, where a reporter's actually asking him about directed energy weapons, and he and his sidekick are up at the front talking about, you know, the fact that we created all this technology, but we aren't using it, that whole thing. So that's a really good video to watch.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I tried to tie that in with the information I was able to find in the Iraq War, where there are about three videos that I found online in YouTube and all of my research that showed a chief surgeon in Iraq, which he could not identify the weapons that were used to sever limbs and to cause, you know, severe damage on the human body of, like, a number of different people who had been attacked in Iraq when the first, you know, the war came about, and they were actually using new technologies dealing with directed energy weapons attacks, and had a voice of God command that had literally thousands of people surrendering and putting down their weapons and coming out and not even fighting. They were like, we'd completely give up, because they were getting the voice of their God in their head saying to give up their weapons and to surrender. And this is on Dr. Robert Duncan's in his books and stuff like that. It's literally called The Voice of God, and it's also called Frey Microwave Hearing, FREY Microwave Hearing, and then you also hear it termed voice to skull technology, and then V2K. So it's got like four separate names in terms of that particular technology. And I showed a couple of videos on that, and then went into the gaslighting term, which was the movie that Ingrid Bergman was in, describing a lot of the gang stalking activities, and where you know, target is often, you know, basically followed through the community and mobbed, or there's organized stalking involved, and different things like that, to basically try to drive the target crazy. So I tried to explain all of these technologies and what I'm finding in my interviews with dozens of other targeted individuals and corroborating stories. And I've done a series of about four interviews on the Research Rabbit Hole radio show, actually bringing on targeted individuals to corroborate their stories and find out what are the commonalities, what are the differences, how did each person come into this, you know. So it's a whole story within itself, and I'm getting just boatloads of information on each person's individual story, and I'm meeting people in San Diego. I'm having coffee with them, and you know, like, finding if they would be a good radio show guest, and then, you know, in that process, I'm finding out all of this data and information that, you know, has been talked about in some other books, but I'm trying to get a handle on it where we can break it down and actually show the different categories of how these people came in, and trying to do kind of a marketing analysis and, you know, almost like a profile of what's going on with this whole thing. And as you and I discussed, Ron, some of this is tied in with technologies that are being built in San Diego, such as Raytheon and some other national defense contractors. So that's the next step of this, to try to make sense of what they're doing with technology in and around the area, and why this area of Southern California has become a hotbed of, you know, targeting, why they're actually targeting people here versus other areas of the country. Because even in, you know, Jesse Ventura's video on the map, when they showed the whole map of the United States, there's a huge concentration of activity with targeted individuals in and around Southern California and in California in general, as opposed to other states in the United States. And I believe New York State and New York City was the other area that was like a hotbed of activity. But basically, these two areas, it looks like, are being used as a testing ground to pull people into this program. So that was kind of the root of my talk. And we did a couple of videos on Nikola Tesla and tying his work in with this, and then going into a video on Fry microwave hearing, and just introducing some other concepts, such as the a Presidential Commission of Bioethics led by Amy Gettman, where 20 people give testimony of being targeted with covert electronic harassment technologies in their homes, offices, and cars. So I introduced those videos. And so that was the bulk of mine. I'll go ahead and get back to you, Ron, where you can talk about the other speakers.
Right, but I just wanted to maybe further elaborate on some of the things that you just said. And I don't know if I spoke to you regarding this in the past, but when I was studying trauma-based mind control back in the 1990s and going through some of the declassified MKUltra documents, which sadly there's only about 20% of what was actually put out during the church hearings in 1977, you know, was actually put out to the public. Probably the another 80% was destroyed. So there's just very little information about that whole mind control program. But within some of the documentation was very revealing. And one part of it, and I'll try to send it to you, I'll look for it, but it has to do with various types of elements such as electroshock, hypnosis, drugs, deprivation, and other various means of torture to disable or discredit the subject.
Yeah.
So it pretty much even spelled it back out. Then in those days, they were using a different type of mind control to discredit or disable an individual to make them look like they were crazy. And so I think that's very revealing information. So if people say, oh, why did the government wouldn't do something like that? Well, it's spelled out. And years ago, they were doing this different way. And then another thing I wanted to mention is when I used to work for a security firm back in the early 90s, I had a supervisor who had worked for the DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency. And, you know, I had a lot of time at my post to read and write, and he was asking, hey, what are you writing about? And I told him, oh, I'm writing about CIA mind control. And he was, like, flipping out. He's going, what? What the hell are you talking about? So I told him, I was up front, and he goes, we got to talk about this, Mr. Patton. And I go, am I in trouble? And he goes, no, not for me. So anyway, he read through my material, and he was very concerned about me because he knew when he was in the DIA, and what he used to do is he used to keep tabs on military personnel with top secret or above clearance. And so he knew the game. And he was like at places like China Lake Naval Weapons Center and Fort Irwin and a lot of Palmdale, 29 Palms, a lot of these secret bases all over the place in California. Nellis Air Force Base. But anyway, he remembered overhearing doctors saying, and they were like joking about it, and they were just saying, oh, it's so easy to create artificial schizophrenia or any, pretty much any type of mental health disorder. And this was back in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, this technology developed in 58 with the Frey microwave hearing. So they've had like 55 years to perfect that. Yeah.
Right, and this was done on a very more primitive level, I guess you could say, not so high tech, but they were very much involved in thinking about creating artificial mental disorders to, again, discredit, especially schizophrenia, to discredit people. So this stuff has been going on for years and years. And again, if we can show that the patents exist, the technology exists, the motivation exists, then most likely it's happening. And so this is something that a lot of people don't want to believe. And it is kind of scary when you think about it, because that means everyone is vulnerable to this technology.
Yeah.
And so it's like I hear some people say, well, what's the point in living? Where's the hope? You know? And all I can tell people on a personal level is, well, you know, and it sounds so simple, but the hope lies within us. You know, we need to develop our own spirituality. I know there might be some people that don't believe in that kind of stuff, but I'm not a religious person per se, but I believe that there are forces in the universe that are much more powerful than us, and those forces know what's going on. And personally,
well,
I believe forces are what's protecting me.
Yes, definitely. One of the things that I tried to tie in with mine towards the end of it was the patents, the U.S. patents that are actually on psychotronic warfare. And, you know, there's a whole page that I dedicated to this on my blog under the Research Rabbit Hole blogspot.com, where it's talking about our, you know, U.S. patents. And one of the first things that I did when I was doing the chemtrail research and began with Awakened Radio was I pulled on a U.S. patent attorney, and she did about 15 minutes in my segment to confirm how difficult it is to actually get a U.S. patent. And it's basically around 9,000 to 13,000 or so just to file a regular patent. That does not include hiring the attorney to write the patent. So when people go for a U.S. patent, this is an extremely expensive process, and it requires typically, you know, the expertise of an attorney bringing them on board. And sometimes these are starting at over $60,000 for an attorney that's coming in with a major law firm. And sometimes they do a different, you know, price assessment based on their office or whatever. But at least the thing is starting at $9,000 to $13,000 just to file the patent. So when people are spending that type of money, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is a major, you know, idea and concept with a U.S. patent.
Exactly. And a lot of this highly sophisticated technology or directed energy weapons, a lot of it was developed at Los Alamos National Laboratories in New Mexico, along with other places. But, you know, some of this, I remember listening to Roger Tolsis years ago. He was talking about, he's an electronics expert, and he was helping a lot of targeted individuals or suspected targeted individuals, help setting them up with diagnostic equipment to sort of validate and verify that they were actually being attacked with these weapons.
Wow.
And anyway, he said that, you know what, any Joe can actually create some of these weapons out of like a microwave oven. You can just retrofit a microwave oven and and create some sort of beam, and it might be totally accurate, but you can certainly do devastation to somebody from, let's say, one apartment to the other. And he knows of people that are just kind of tinkering around with certain types of electronic devices that can be retrofitted into a weapon. So, again, it's not too far-fetched. It's not too far out there like a lot of people think. And we've talked about this before, that unfortunately society is just overwhelmed, inundated with cognitive dissonance. They prefer to be in denial, and they don't want to believe something could be so horrific.
Yes, definitely. It's, you know, something that I face, you know, every time I talk with somebody and they don't understand what I'm writing about and how this ties in with chemtrails. And, you know, it's like, it's unbelievable when you start doing this research and see all the tie-ins with, you know, this leads to that, to this, to that. And then a lot of people can't follow it. Like, they're not the big picture type visionary where they can actually see this whole thing and see different parts connecting. But if you step back from it and look at it as an overview, all of this is connected. And, you know, I've interviewed people who are really far down into just one aspect of it, like, say, psychotronic weapons or something, and sometimes they can't see the complete picture that this is linked directly to chemtrails, that you have to have almost the chemtrails in order to diffuse the sky to create it into a conduit to administer this type of psychotronic weaponry directly to a target. So some people are not seeing that, and they're not seeing the fact that people need to be breathing and absorbed in the chemtrail particulate and smart dust in order to become a, you know, radioactive infrared body heat pattern where they can be tracked by these weapons. So when you really start breaking it down and looking at this whole thing, it's ingenious. I mean, whoever thought of this whole thing and put all of this together was way out there. This goes way beyond Frankenstein, don't you think, Ron?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And again, this is just what we do know. Imagine what's really going on that, you know, we don't know.
Yeah.
It can be a very, you know, ominous and scary thing. But again, I think if we developed our inner being, our spirituality, I think we can see the bigger picture and hopefully not be too overwhelmed by it. And, you know, to be able to love ourselves and to be able to love other people and to live a balanced life. And, I mean, that's what I strive for, because there are a lot of people who make the assumption that, well, that's all you think about or talk about is conspiracy or this, that. And I go, I really don't. I mean, it's something that intrigues me a lot. But I think people like you and I and Andy and a lot of the speakers and, you know, a lot of the attendees of the ParanoiaCon are such that we think, obviously, outside of the box. We think in a multi-dimensional way. However, I was just talking to somebody who was just sort of walking by, and he's, you know, we were talking exactly that, linear thinking versus multi-dimensional thinking. And, you know, I was saying that I listened to this one professor from Oxford who was speaking at a conference in Washington State, and he said, we're lucky to have about 3% of the human population to really think outside the box and to kind of get it, have an idea of really what's going on. About 97% really have no idea, nor do they want to have any idea, because it's been a very gradual dumbing down process throughout history. And this is done partly genetically, partly environmentally, partly spiritually. And so it's a very multifarious thing that's been placed upon the human population. And
yes,
they only want a very small percentage of the population, and that's namely the elite, to be truly enlightened.
Yes, I think Lennon also brought up in his presentation the information overload situation that's happening with something like, say, the 9/11 story, where they just bombard you like with 8 hours of all these different stories, and half of which are, you know, absolutely made no sense and were probably complete fabrications just added to the story to distract and pull people off center where they couldn't actually see and zero in on what even happened that day. And then imagine what's really going on right now with all these different things where people are texting and emailing, and you know, their Facebook news feed is filled with, you know, thousands of different news reports and all this stuff. So all of this stuff is kind of designed to pull people off center where they don't have the time to even assess what's really going on. You know, they can't see the forest for the trees because there's just too many trees. So there's a lot of action going on and a lot of, you know, like what he mentioned, like complete sensory overload, just too much going on to even get zero in on one thing, let alone seeing the whole big picture of all that's going on.
Right. And along with that, too, is the creation of the spin by spinning a lot of spurious or tangent theories that people will grab onto. And even within the conspiracy theorists or conspiracy theory realm of people putting out information without really verifying or validating it and sort of discrediting what's really going on. Some of that is done on purpose, which is disinformation, and some of that is done unwittingly because people aren't doing their homework. And so when people grab on to disinformation that way, it's called misinformation. So, but unfortunately, that's what the media has actually been doing that fairly regularly since the JFK assassination. That's why there are so many different theories. Again, if you spin a lot of different theories, you know, people are going, oh, what's right? Who's right about this? How are we ever going to know what the truth is? And so it's sort of ingenious in a way to be able to do that, just because, again, that causes a lot of confusion, and then the cognitive dissonance sets in, and then the denial sets in, and people just, you know, kind of roll their eyes and throw up their arms. I don't know what to believe. So, you know, that's, I think, where most people are at, the 97% of the people within the population are like that.
Yes, definitely. And, yeah, just looking at what happened with the 9/11 story compared to the JFK story, the one thing that I don't think that they were anticipating was the fact that the internet and YouTube would come along where they could actually see videos of what was happening with all the news stories and the difference between all of the official story that was released that day by the major news networks. I mean, they were not anticipating that people were going to analyze that a news story came out 20 minutes before Building 7 even fell to announce that the building had already fallen. I mean, where would they get this information? I mean, that must have been completely contrived to start with for them to have even announced that. Don't you think, Ron?
No, very much so. So, yeah, basically it was a lot easier to cover up some of the conspiratorial acts, you know, back in the early 60s and even prior to that, and some of the other false flag operations, because the information flow was a lot slower and a lot more sporadic. So I know we only have probably a little bit of time here. And
yeah,
we've
got about 8 minutes left. Yeah.
Right. And so I wanted to touch upon the final presenters of the day.
Yes.
And that happened to be Phil Lernes, who's a film director and producer up in Los Angeles, and his sidekick and good friend Dean Haglund, who is an actor. He was featured in The X-Files as Langley. He's one of the competing dudes, also known as the Lone Gunman. And so both of them were there for the 2 days, and they were doing some interviews for another movie that they plan on making. But what they did is they happened to show the their documentary, which was made approximately 2 years ago, called "The Truth Is Out There." And basically what that had to do is sort of a look at maybe over the past 50 years how conspiracy theories have become like more prevalent and, you know, as far as topics of discussion or cause for alarm. But at the same time, it's sort of like, what do people really think about conspiracies? And about not more than just conspiracies, about consciousness. And I think what they were really trying to do is to dig deep into people's beliefs, what they believe in and why they believe in certain things. And Dean Haglund, I think, did an excellent job. He's an improv comedian and actor, too. And so they showed some of his artistic talent in doing that. But I just really liked the way that he was interviewing people and sort of kind of changing things up a little bit, you know, lightening things up so people could feel comfortable during the interview when they were talking about, you know, some very serious topics.
Yes, that was excellent. And I love their radio show, too, that they did where they allowed the audience to ask questions and interact with them. So that was an incredible part of the day on Sunday. And thank you so much for bringing them to your Paranoia Con, because, I mean, that was really enlightening, and it was great to actually get a chance to talk with them and meet them in person. That was awesome.
Right, and with that said, there was some discussion about doing a The Truth Is Out There conference actually in Los Angeles, possibly this spring, where we would sort of bring together both sci-fi, conspiracy, and the paranormal together in sort of a an expo of film, music, and presentations. So look forward to that, hopefully within the not-too-distant future. There'll be more information on that.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Very cool. And anything else that you'd like to say in the last 3.5 or so minutes?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, point out that our latest issue of Paranoia Magazine is out. It was slightly delayed, but it's ready for people to take a look at. And unfortunately, it's not going through the regular distribution routes at many newsstands, as I had some difficulty with my distributor. So pretty much the only way people can purchase it would be on the internet through our subscription store. But I just wanted to touch really quickly on some of the titles of the summer issue of Paranoia Magazine. We have an article called Return of the Phoenix, The Four Sons of an Intruder Planet. And we have The Dead Comedian Conspiracy, and that's by Adam Gorightly, who is one of our speakers. And then we have a very intriguing article by a friend of mine, Elisa, who's an MKUltra survivor. And so she kind of gets into this cloning topic, and the title of her article is called Hidden in Plain Sight, Elisa Programming and Body Cloning. And I think one of the articles that I found very disturbing yet extremely informative is called A History of Silence, and it has to do with child trafficking in the United States. And that was written by an MKUltra survivor by the name of David Schroeder, who wrote a book called Rabbit Hole, Satanic Ritual Abuse Survivor Story. And he really gets in-depth about the whole Franklin scandal, what, you know, occurred back in the Midwest, back in the 1980s and 1990s, regarding these highly sophisticated pedophile rings that were, you know, talked about in the book by John DeCamp, The Franklin Cover-Up. But he gives it, he goes even more in depth into that. So I would ask your audience to, you know, check out this coming issue, because it seems to be getting better and better.
Well, yeah, excellent. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you and Andy for being on the show. I really appreciate it, and glad that we could relay all this information to the public, because it was a fabulous conference, and I hope more people will show up next time, and it was awesome. Thanks so much, Ron. Great to have you all on. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Andy says thank you. Okay, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Ann.